G'day everyone, and welcome to Season 3 of A Place to Call Home. And yes, you can hear a bit of excitement in my voice. I'm stoked to be bringing you Season 3 and be back for another year. So straight off the bat, I just want to say a massive thank you to everyone who's listened to the episodes last year and who've jumped on board, who followed, who left us a rating. You guys are amazing, and thank you. And hence why there's another season that you're listening to. So I really hope you enjoy it. Anyway, to kick things off for Season 3, I have a bit of a doozy, and I do apologize. It is a bit long, but honestly, these guys were incredible, and I had 1,000 questions, and they were so open and honest with sharing their story. So for Season 3, Episode 1, I introduced you guys to Kale and Karen from Butcher to Go. Now, if you don't know about Butcher to Go, they are Queensland's only self-serve butchery, located right here in North Queensland in Townsville. They also have an incredible story and a journey that they tell to leading up to where they are now, what they're doing with Butcher to Go. That we chat about succession, we chat about working out west, starting a fencing contracting, raising kids, also a bit of a high school sweetheart love story in there as well. And we also touch on Kale's journey of sobriety, which I was so thankful for him to share, and it was really quite interesting, and he raises some pretty important topics around that. So I really hope you guys enjoy this one, and welcome to Season 3. And if you're, no matter if you're sitting in a car, sitting on a horse, sitting on a bike, or maybe you're sitting in an office, I really hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you very much. I apologize, guys, before we jump into the episode, I want to say a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, which is Butcher to Go. So you're going to find out a hell of a lot more about Butcher to Go in this episode, and I'm really excited for that. But if you're in Townsville and you're driving down Charters Towers Road, you will see Queensland's only manless butcher shops. Now, if you guys are keen to get involved, we're going to talk a bit more how easy it is to set up your own account and start getting onto some great clean green beef and also goats. So check it out, and thank you very much for Butcher to Go for jumping on and sponsoring this episode. Well, g'day and welcome to A Place to Call Home, and thank you very much for joining us, the Robinsons from Butcher to Go. Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, can you tell me a bit about yourself? Where do you live? What do you do? And you can throw in a few family stats because it blew me away.
Yeah, no worries, Sam. Kale Robinson. Living in Charters Towers currently. Originally born, bred up in southwest Queensland, southwest of Winton, on a 110,000 acre cattle property there in the Channel Country. And yeah, got five boys, and
that's good.
Bloody, yeah, just rearing them, putting them through school, do a bit of contract fencing, and yeah, got a goat farm out at north of Muttaburra. But I'll let Karen introduce herself now, my darling wife, my first wife.
So I'm Karen. Kale's pretty much summed it all up. But I grew up out near Homestead. Mum and dad, that's where I did my primary years. And then they had a bit of land out near Pentland, outside of Pentland. We met at school. We were high school sweethearts in grade 12. And then we decided to go our separate ways after school. He wanted to go out west and I wasn't ready for that. So I went down Brizzy and did a few things down there. We found each other later on in life, and yeah, the rest is history.
You guys have jumped ahead a bit there. I didn't want to give away straight away that your high school sweetheart. I like that, but it's so you guys both grew up in Western Queensland. One of the best places in Australia, obviously. But where did you guys go to school? Where did you first meet?
So Blackie and Thornborough College, yep, in Charters Towers. I boarded for a couple of years, but Cal did all his schooling boarding. And then Mum and Dad moved to Charters, so I became a day student or a day bug. Yeah.
So what year did you go to school, boarding school, Kyle?
2000.
Yeah, we Yeah, so we graduated 2005.
So just from like year 8 to 12?
Yeah, 8 to 12, yep.
What was it like going from Winton coming across to Charters?
Yeah, well, we were very isolated out there. We were a couple of hundred k's south of Winton, so never really had too much social interaction, hadn't played any sport or anything like that, so I couldn't really catch a footy when I went to school, but I mean, yeah, it was fun. It was a bit, you know, homesick for the first 6 months or whatever, but yeah, heaps of kids were homesick, but after that, I loved it.
Yeah,
loved it.
Karen, I'm going to fast forward a bit because you guys got a pretty incredible story, but I just wanted to touch on, so you actually went away to Brisbane before coming back out west. What were you doing in Brisbane again?
She was modelling.
Modelling.
Yeah, she didn't want to say it, but I dobbed her in there.
Will you be the first model I've had on the podcast? Yeah.
Thank you. Famous one, but so basically I fell into the modelling world.
Yep.
And I didn't know what I wanted to do after school. Oh, thank you. Yes. I didn't know what I wanted to do after school. So I just thought, well, we'll give it a try. Because I never was never really a big part of my world, like that side of things, of beauty and everything like that. I was a bit rough. And but for some reason this modelling agency in Brizzy saw something and I went there, and not long after arriving in Brisbane they sent me overseas for a bit.
Yeah. That is cool. That's a whole nother podcast episode itself. Like, yeah. So how many years were you doing that? Like, and you travelled around obviously a bit.
Well,
like
I did 3 months stint in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
That was my first contract. And when I came back, I was like, oh, this is like got a bit more, I really enjoyed it, don't get me wrong, but it became more of a business and I wasn't probably really ready for that. So, but I ended up working at the agency, being their model booker, but there's a bit of a gap there, but eventually that's what I ended up doing. And I really, really enjoyed that. So I ended up booking the models for their jobs and lines with the clients, which was really fun. And I think they just really enjoyed a northern country girl just to talk to, you know? So, it was really fun. And then Kale convinced me to move out west and go out fencing.
See, you guys were still together. You're just doing a bit of long distance. Are you still in contact?
No, there's a whole other story.
We'll do about three episodes on there. But you guys are still obviously talking to each other, and then you decided to come back out west?
No. Well, this is where our stories get a little bit different. So we always stayed in really good touch.
Yeah.
Anyway, Cal did a bit of traveling after he went to school, which he can talk about that. But we always stayed really, really good mates. And after I come back from overseas, I sort of stepped away from the modelling a little bit and then became a PA for a principal at a real estate agency, which was really cool. I really am grateful for that opportunity because she was probably one of my role models I put down as women in my life. And she sold the agency. Then I decided to move back up to Townsville because I just was missing
North Queensland.
Kale still claims to the day, and I think we'll argue this until our deathbeds, that I moved back to win him back.
Yeah. I think that's,
exactly what happened.
Just keep telling you.
So, because not long after I moved to Townsville, that's when the modelling agency rang me and said, Carrie, we'd love to have you as a model booker. And then I moved back.
Yeah.
So it was a very short time I was up. And then, so that's why he claims that I moved just to win him back so I could move back to Brisbane. I did convince him to be stationed at, because he was fly in, fly out, to go to Brizzy with me. But then he did convince me to go out west after that.
So, Kay, what was your journey like after school? You said you headed west. What did you get up to?
So basically just went contract mustering, like day work for people and whatnot, and so that probably about a year or something. And then me and my cousin went over to Canada and done like a snow season over at Whistler.
Yeah.
Snowboarding. And that was a big change.
You and probably 1,000 other Aussies.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to spot a Canadian in Whistler. There's that many bloody Aussies there, but no, it was a fun time.
Yeah.
And then come home and I thought I better sort my life out. And I started an apprenticeship, an electrical apprenticeship in Townsville, and done that for 6 months, but the money was not good.
Yeah.
And like, you just, it wasn't my thing, you know. I'm used to 12-hour days and, you know, you'd work hard for a couple of weeks and have, you know, 3 or 4 days off, yeah, or a week off or something. But every weekend off and going and partying, and you have no money left all the time. And anyway, that's when Karen was in Townsville, so our paths crossed again.
Yeah.
And, then I was like, had enough of the apprenticeship and went drilling, fly in, fly out. And so I could be based anywhere. So I based myself back down at Brisbane with Karen, which was, it was different down there. Like the traffic, and I could drive, but I only knew my way how to get to Karen to pick her up.
And she drives her.
Oh, going down one-way lanes and peak hour traffic, mate, and they're going the wrong way. And I just get out of the car and let her drive now. Anywhere.
Yeah, I prefer to drive.
Yeah.
To this day, if we go in the city, I drive.
I think I'm a bit this game. I think I scare my wife when I head into the city and start driving. I'm not used to all these cars. But hey, I'm gonna fast forward a bit. I want to talk about you guys actually moving back to Winton. What drew you guys back to Winton, and what was the reasons why you moved back out there initially? Because you went back out there to work on your family property, yeah, is that right? And start a bit, yeah, of a process there?
Yeah, that's right. So I think I just seen mining as something that, you know, it's just a job and,
yep,
it's not what I loved. I seen no long-term future in it, I suppose, for myself. So I always loved the land and the country. Like, that was where my heart was. So I suppose that was the best option, to go back to my father's place and work there. And then obviously I convinced Karen to come out, the model from the city coming to Winton, then out to the middle of nowhere.
How was that, Karen? How was that transition moving out to Winton? Because that's a big difference from Homestead where you grew up in Brisbane.
Yeah. So it's funny, that was what, you know, not that we told anybody that was my background, but small towns, they, yep, seem to be able to gather this information before I arrived. So everyone was waiting for this cow bringing back this model from Brisbane. I was like, that's not the best, you know, first way to meet someone. But it was, I had already had the experience of mum and dad having the properties, and,
yep,
so it wasn't a huge shock for me, and I actually love it. I loved being from in the Brisbane. It's a bit like the concrete jungle, yeah, right? So when you go out west, you really appreciate the raw beauty of it. And I just remember the sun when we were driving out and the sunsets. And I actually still remember this day. There's a visual memory. I would sometimes just head back to do some major jobs, just like the peak times. They'd get me back.
So you're still on contract almost back?
Yeah, I was still on the books. When I left the booking job, they said, well, if we ever get any jobs, we'll let you know. And they did, which was great. And I just remember flying from Brisbane to Winton, and I remember flying in. I don't know if you've ever been to the airport there, but like, it's just like the track going up to the airport. And as we were flying in, there was like kangaroos jumping off the airstrip, and I could see Cal driving up in these ute to pick me up. And I thought, this is so cool. But I really loved it. We really enjoyed working together, which...
And you were working with Cal's family at the time. How was that working in that family environment?
Yeah, so his parents aren't together, so it was just his dad,
yep,
out, sorry, on the property. No, that's all right. And so he was probably happy to have some company because he's been on his own for a while. And Nick was very welcoming and created a nice environment for us there. He was very, you know, patient because I did not have the skills as what most people would out there.
Mm.
And
I think I just loved doing something new, you know, and it was fun and exciting.
Bit of an adventure.
Bit of an adventure. It soon, though, came, which came to realize that we probably couldn't stay there on a wage.
So is this about the time, Carl, you started doing contract fencing around the area?
Yeah, so this was a time when, like, oh, there was a lot going on.
Live export ban droughts.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that period.
Wasn't quite the live export ban yet, but it was very dry.
Yep.
I don't think we really had a good season out there. But also, me and Karen had done some silly things. Like, we bought a unit in Brisbane while we were there, and we also bought a house in Townsville.
Trying to get some asset.
Yeah, exactly. And Karen had a house in Brisbane as well, half shares with an ex-boyfriend. And
which I bought when I was 19.
This was the time when the banks were just handing money out.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like before the GFC, right? So we bought these places, no money down, and like got ourselves into, I think it was like $800,000 debt.
Yeah.
But then on top of that, the banks overvalued my unit in Brisbane. So I went and got a line of credit on that as well. And so we had a lot of bills to pay. We couldn't just survive on a normal income from Dad, and he was struggling to pay us too. So we decided we'd go contract fencing. And
not in our own business.
But. Well, we worked for someone else for a year or two, and then obviously, we started our own business. And that's when Sam was born. I think Sam was like
when we sent the quote away to our first client.
For fencing client.
For fencing.
For your own job.
We were waiting for Sam to be born. Yeah. And so he was 3 months old when we went out for our first job. And we just were in a caravan. And yeah, we were just so excited. Just taking this newborn baby with us.
And meanwhile, like Carl was saying, you got all this pressure behind you from the bank. Well, you would start having this from the bank starting up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like then the GFC obviously came, and it was bank values were really low. But anyway, we were happy. We'd hit the big time. We were contract fencers now. And so then what did we do? We had a car loan. We had to buy a car as well.
Set yourselves up.
Yeah, we didn't buy it through the bank either. It would have been car company thing just to get the finance. And then we decided we were going to buy cattle, and we borrowed money off Landmark on some like ridiculous terms.
That trading.
It was
one of those livestock loans.
Like, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It was a livestock loan, but I mean, it was very high interest.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah. I think you had to pay it back after a year or something. So anyway, we were just making mistakes left, right, and center, getting ourselves into a lot of debt.
Looking back now, like, you know, you were a young couple, ambitious couple trying to have a crack. That's all you were.
Yeah.
What was something that you learned through then? Was it just to like slow down a little bit, not have such a big crack? Or what was something that you learned along that process at the end of it?
Just dentate, would you say? I think when we entered that world of investing, the terminology getting around was using the bank's money and all that side of things. So we definitely have transitioned out of that now, in the sense of good debt, bad debt, what's your debt to equity ratio? Like, we definitely make more calculated decisions, and then it's like, she'll be right.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we were relying a lot on capital gains rather than positive cash flow, and that having that negative cash flow really
knocked you around,
dragged us down with the properties. And with the other loans, I think you're better off waiting until the bank can give you money to get a cheaper interest rate rather than going with what whoever gives you money at the time just to get what it's probably a bit of patience.
Yeah, we tend to lend patience.
So what was the end result of this? Like what happened? Like you're at Winton there, you're working away, mostly contract fencing, all these debts piling up. Was it turning point or a tipping point that happened?
Not particularly in a financial way, but we had another couple of kids, and so Karen wasn't out on the fence line with us anymore.
I said to him, when I have a third kid, I'm not going to be out on the fence line anymore, and we end up having a third child.
But it'll be full on in the household with three. Yeah, it is full on with the household with three kids. Yeah.
And round now is when the live export ban came and just crippled the industry. There was very little work around. I think I was just working on a day rate
everyone forgets that. I was contracting around then too, and I'm just contract mastering.
Yeah.
And I just remember it. I remember just having work, just no work. I ended up picking up like a gig working in the Shire, like from the Shire supporting me. But it was around this time where it was like drought, then live export. Like everyone kind of forgets how hard it hit North Queensland. Like us, like there were families that crumbled.
I remember sitting on the back of the ute with my mate after we just finished mustering, and we said, geez, if we could just get $2 a kilo, we'd be right, you know? It'd be a good business if we could get $2 a kilo.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the tipping point probably was just, I mean, it was more emotional. Like I'd started drinking a lot.
Yeah.
And that was putting even more pressure on the family environment and the working away more and more and more. And we kind of got saved by Karen's mum and dad, I suppose, in a way. They ended up buying a property outside of Ravenswood, which is down close to the coast near Ayre, and asked us to come and manage it for them. So,
I want to touch on, and thank you for sharing that, like your journey, like drinking and stuff. I want to touch on that again. I think you guys just have so much happen in such like a short period between having three kids, the live export drought, and then actually leaving your family's property and moving to Karen's. Like in the short space of time, it seemed like, I don't know how much more you could fit in. That's
well,
a bit of stress
we were on. Looking at the timeline, Sam, and I think we started our business. Sam was born in 2011. We got married in 2012. We had Ryan in 2013. Then we had Jake 2014. And I think 2015 or at the end of 2015, we moved to Hillsborough outside Ravenswood. So it was just a boom, boom, boom. And really didn't, we haven't really slowed down since then.
What's the saying? If you want to find something, you want to get something done, give it to a busy person. Kale, touching on like the drinking, did you get help to stop? Because like at the end of it, you've stopped drinking. You don't drink anymore.
Yeah, that's
did
right.
Did you have help to get
So it? Probably that happened a lot. Like Later. It was only becoming a problem back then. And then, I mean, it was a full-blown problem. I suppose it was more accepted out west. Like a lot of my friends drank, was just the dumb thing sort of thing. But when I got exposed to different environments down on like the coast and different groups of people through some of the education stuff we did, I realized that I did have a problem. And then it's probably the thing, like in the end, it was either my marriage and kids was going to be gone or,
you didn't stop.
Yeah, or, you know, I had to do something. And it was the toughest thing I've ever done in my life, stopping. I went and done it's like an educational program.
Development?
Landmark.
Yeah.
And that sort of, it's a tough, tough program. It really breaks you apart and makes you get to the nitty gritty of your soul, I suppose. And
have a good look.
That's when, good look at things and realize like it's just not worth losing my family. And I always tried to cut down all the time. Like Karen was, you know, up me all the time. So I'd cut down for a month or something, nothing. Like it's for me, one's too many, 100's not enough. Mm. And it's all in or all out. And it was just had to be all out, mate. So
how many years sober now?
Probably, I've not really counted, but over two.
Cool.
Yeah. It will be. But I mean, it's tough mentally to get your head around that you're a non-drinker. But once you get your head around it, you actually start to realize how much people actually don't drink.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, they might have two or three beers, but they're not drunk.
No.
But every occasion I'd go to I'd be drunk.
Yeah.
And I'd be the drunkest one.
Yeah.
And it was embarrassing for Karen and, you know,
It's some incredible way that the okay to say no.
Yeah.
Group's doing, Shanawan, stuff like that. Like, it's incredible what they're doing there because it is just promoting that different culture in rural Australia, which, like you said, like, it's sometimes it's who you surround yourself with. You get stuck in that group, stuck in that mentality where it's not just one drink, it's 100, like you said.
Yeah.
It's tough to break away and go out on your own, yeah.
The biggest fear I had was, like, would I lose my mates?
Yeah.
And that didn't really happen. Probably formed better relationships with my mates since because, you know, everything's real. It's not piss talk. So that's been for the better, and I'm hardly even think about it now anymore. So
thank you for sharing that.
No, well, good, mate.
It's, I have a bad habit, probably a good habit with this podcast, is that when I find something interesting, I'm quite happy to ask questions and go on a tangent. But bringing it back to you guys after Winton, you moved on from Winton and you went into business with Karen's family. Is that what you guys did, or what was the process there that went on with that Ravenswood block and you guys?
We went and helped Mum and Dad run the Ravenswood block.
So you're just managing it?
Yeah. And with the, we sat down at the table and worked a few things out of what we would get wage-wise and when the property was sold, because Mum and Dad have had success in the past of going in and doing some work to blocks and then on selling. Yep. So there was talk about what that would look like when the block was sold, et cetera. Which is when we moved there, it was great. There was a school just 15 minutes down the road so the kids could go to school.
Yeah.
And
it's a lovely little community.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a big learning curve because, it was different country to what Kale was used to.
Yeah.
And it's quite hilly. We brought one of our workers that we had working for us with us, and we were mustering for the first time, and he went to get a beast through this tree but didn't realize what it was. It was Chinese apple, and he came out the other side all cut up, you know. So it was just a learning curve for everybody. And but I suppose, you know, then we realized because we were heavily involved in the management side of things where I'd pay all the bills and you had access to the bank and stuff like that. And Cal was on ground. I was in the office. And we realized that we couldn't do the initial wage, so we brought it back down to 50 grand a year, plus all your extras, you know, like we don't pay rent and all that sort of jazz. Yeah. But the problem was because we had accumulated so much of our assets that needed servicing, like really that wage was probably going mostly on the bills as such and like extra living expenses having a young family. But really moving to Hillsborough was probably the massive changing point in our lives because we were lucky enough to be introduced. We had a phone call one night from a lady who worked for NQ Dry Tropics, and she said, "We're doing this program. We'd love to have you part of it." It was to do with the reef and trying to reduce the sediment runoff into the reef, and we were in that catchment. So, and luckily for us, you know, and you've got to remember we came from out west where that any thinking of towards regen ag or working to save the reef or anything, that was not a conversation that we'd ever had before. And it was probably a little bit in the greeny section, if yeah. that makes sense. And no, none of our friends were into it, or we had, you know, never been exposed to that, any of that sort of language. So when this phone call came through, but to do part of the program was they would help with fencing, and there was infrastructure help there just to try and get the graziers started reducing the sediment runoff through grazing, different grazing practices, et cetera. But to do that, you had to do education along with that. And I think that it was being the biggest game changer in our life.
Starting to get education.
Yeah, because I think they did so well in the sense of not just handing this money over to do infrastructure, but realizing that we really need to educate the graziers on why we're doing it, mm-hmm. not just so they can just get a fence up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we got put into a 3-year program with RCS. We've done Executive Link. Which is like you go onto a board.
But first we...
Well, you do grazing for profit first, which is the week course, and then you go onto a... You go onto a board with another 5
businesses,
and you're open with your, you know, financials and how the business is going, and you benchmark against other businesses, and you can see how you're performing in the industry.
Yeah.
And whether... You know, overheads are too high or direct costs, and anyway, it's
a great program. Well, Mum and Dad did a real
It's amazing, mate. But it'd be $30,000 if you had to pay for it yourself, and we got it for free.
That's incredible.
Just because they wanted to save the sediment going into. It was called Project Pioneer.
Yeah,
massive program.
Go back to GF, feel like that phone call and saying. It was free, which is why we did it.
Yeah, like we would never have done any of this education unless it was for free, I think.
Initially.
Just because
just we Just initially? Thought, like,
yeah. Just initially.
But looking back now, what you've got out of those programs.
Oh, it was worth every cent.
Yeah,
I think.
Just at the time you weren't exposed to it, so you didn't realise the benefit.
Yeah, exactly. And like when you hear grazing for profit, you think, of course, everyone wants to graze for profit. You know what I mean? Like, that's a no-brainer, but it's not just like learning about grass and stuff. It's about planning and goal setting and our visions and stuff. And that when we set proper goals and whatever it certainly boosted us along.
So during this period while you guys were there, you really educated yourself, upskilled yourself through the help of NQ Dry Tropics, and like, there's some amazing work that like the natural resource management groups like that do, and supporting graziers and prime producers in different ways. And like, it's great to give them a shout out, because I think not enough people know that.
Well,
different opportunities.
There's not much out west though.
No, there are like, you know, when you start where you guys would have been a desert channel, and we're in Southern Gulf, like different catchments have different, where they focus on different things. But I think, to say it bluntly, they've got the reef right there.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of government funding goes into looking after that. Yeah. So that's why they would secure a lot more money to be able to do things like the Pioneer Project and stuff.
Yeah.
How was it? So you guys are working in the family business. You said you reduced your wage. You started doing all these programs and you're having a hard time servicing your outside assets. Is this like... What was happening next with you guys? Like, what was on the next step?
I suppose, like, that's right. And we, you know, as we were always very driven, and we always had these goals that we wanted to achieve, and patience never been our biggest thing. But we soon realised that we probably needed to have some changes. And we've, as a family, as Mum and Dad and us, we sat down and we worked out a plan that we formed a separate company, and we bought another place out near Charter Stowers.
Yep.
And so we were, now we're actually on the books. So I think in the previous, we were just always, there was never anything written down in concrete about what was said. So even with like for banks or anything like that, we never
You're just
really.
On the way.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like on
workers.
Paper, which is hard, you know, like, you know, there's an agreement there, but on paper there wasn't. So, which was great. So then we were able to, once again, with help Mum and Dad, form this company, and we bought the Palomana. So that was really, then we had full control. Mum and dad were silent partners in that, and they were really good at that. Like very supportive in that way. Like they said, okay, well, this is your shot. And we had literally full control. And yeah, we were able to start really implementing all those things, those past 5 years that we've been learning. Mm-hmm. And even though we were doing a lot of it at Hillsborough, but there was a few things that we really, really wanted to do, but, you know, mum and dad weren't too sure about it. So it was really good. Like we could just have, we had a conversation with ourselves and just do it, you know, whereas sometimes you'd have to do the whole process before. And, you know, like I said, we're very lucky that we've had supportive parents from Kale's side and our side. And yeah, I think then our Palamana journey started, which Kale will probably go in a bit more, I think.
Yeah.
Butcher to Go is Queensland's first self-service meat retail shop. They take immense pride in providing top-notch pasture-raised meat sourced from families right across North and Western Queensland. Their unique membership-based model allows you to conveniently access the shop at any time. It's a modern take on a paddock to plate. If you want to join the revolution, head on over to www.butchertogo.com.au and find out more.
Yeah, so I suppose with the education we learned, we definitely wanted to implement different management techniques, and it was best that we did that with full manager control.
Yep.
So that's probably what Karen said, is we just, Pat and Jenny were bloody nice enough to guarantor us into this property. And we were in the company as 50% shareholders, and they were 50% shareholders. So we went to Palamana, but we were very, very cash poor because we'd only borrowed against their assets. So we had the full debt. We had $4 million debt, and we paid $4 million for it. And we had our own debt plus, I think we only had like 500 or 600 cows. This is before cattle prices were ridiculous. So I went back fencing again to help cover interest and this sort of thing. I mean, we couldn't really do much infrastructure there or anything. We were kind of, I felt like we had very poor debt to equity. We were like 100% debt. So, I mean, we were just so lucky that it was when the property market started to move, and Pat and Jenny sold Hillsborough, and we approached the bank to see if we could take full ownership of Palamana, but the company. So we owned that place outright, but the bank was not going to let go of security of Pat and Jenny, so it was going to hamstring them a lot. And the market had moved, and we thought, why don't we just ring this bloke that we know that is looking for a place? And he come and had a look. And we ended up getting it under contract and sold it. We sold it for $6 million after 18 months. So but 2 years later, he sold that place for $12 million. So
it was a crazy period.
No, it was wild. We captured
the start.
Like a tiny bit of that growth, and
it was the pressure, but looking back, it was the pressure of the cash flow and your situation at the time. Like you kind of bit off a bit more than you could chew, so you had to reassess, get out.
Well, we also saw it as
an opportunity.
Opportunity to, okay, this will allow us to go completely on our own.
Yeah.
You know, and so that whole process from being the manager to owning our own property, which is what we always wanted to do, that could be a reality if we made that sale, you know. And even though, like Cal said, we missed out on some money, but the journey between us selling and buying our next property was also part of our where we got us today, because we were looking around at other properties and then we got exposed to the goats. And we would never would have got exposed to goats if we'd never sold Palomino.
So moving on. Well, sorry.
Oh, I just got to add something to that. Like when we did sell, we had cash in the bank and it was time to breathe. And this is the time when I gave up drinking as well, because it was like I was felt secure, you know, and it was like
weight off the shoulders.
Time to breathe and really look at my life and think, right, what's the next step to, you know, go forward.
Did you guys have a step between, like, I'm going to get to the next next property, but what were you guys doing this in-between phase of selling it, and what was the next step? What happened next?
I think it was 8 months before we bought out at Muttaburra, but we just moved into Charters Towers.
Yep. Okay.
And I kept fencing just to generate cash flow. And that's when the kids started going to school and we started settling in and really liked Charters Towers. We were also looking around for places, but the market was going crazy and we were really, I was especially getting, FOMO if we're ever going to get back in again. And like, it was a bit scary because my father had sold his place at Winton, Pat had sold his place at Ravenswood and we'd sold our place. So there was
No property in the land.
Yeah. And we were like, well, this is a bit worrying because we really want to have some connection there.
I had a chat to someone else, like, you know, it's interesting, the connection that people have to land, like being in agriculture. And you can always, if you reflect back and if you're going through succession and stuff, you think of that and you think of how your parents feel like giving up.
Yeah.
That, because once you, like you just said, like, no, there's no connection to land at that point. If you're born and raised in it, it's part of your blood, you are very lost.
Yeah.
Like if you don't have that connection, you kind of lose yourself a bit. So I can understand the drive to get back into something because it's very strong once you get it. You can't get rid of it. So what was the process towards working towards this next block outside of Muttaburra? How did that come up?
Well, I mean, actually been looking down around Cunnamulla and Thargaminda because the land we thought was good value for what you could produce, and they were running a lot of goats down there, and there was a really good gross margin in goats. Like the percentages that they were quoting of rebreeding rates of 200%, and you know, you could sell weaners goats back then for $100, and you could buy an nanny for 150, so you could more or less pay off the nanny plus make some in the first year. And cows and calves were like $3,000 each, and we were like, well, we need to, and you can run goats on reasonably affordable country in comparison to cattle. So we could look for that cheaper country and still make an income off it down there. And then we'd ended up circling back to a place. We went and looked at Eastfield at Muttaburra, which was very similar to some of that Cunnamulla country that we'd seen with the mulga and Spinifex and different, just so much browse, bushes and a little bit of gidgee and stuff like that. And we just were so dead set on buying goats that we just thought, right, we'll buy this. 25,000 acres, I think we paid like 1.8 for it. Something similar on the downs would have been, you know, up 4, 5, 6 probably. And that was well out of our price range. So we thought we'll just go with the less, like, worse country in most people's eyes and run a different enterprise, and hopefully it would be the right choice. And it made sense on paper. But getting into goats is so different to cattle.
I want to touch on that.
Some learning curves there.
Kyle, you're just starting to mention goats and, like you said, why you selected the property down in Marlborough. What was it like stepping into goats and going from beef into goats? And what made you make that decision?
Well, it was literally a financial decision because we could buy affordable country and still make a good profit off it with the current prices.
Yeah.
So, I mean, return on investment, we could do very well out of the goats on paper, obviously.
Yeah.
But, well, the first biggest thing was that we had to fence it. So we totally exclusion fenced the whole property, which is a massive financial
Jesus
and big job. Like, I think it was like, we've done like 76 kilometers there of fencing off that high stuff, exclusion mesh. And then, like, that's without any help or from the government or whatever, no clusters. But it was, we did it also because we thought it was very important to have total
control,
management control of the grass, because what we'd learnt through RCS and grazing for profit, if you want to do a grass budget, you want to make sure that that grass is still going to be there at the end of the year, not totally eaten by ruse or whatever. So it killed two birds with one stone. And so that was it. Then we just went so hard into the goats, like bought, I don't know, we've probably bought 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 goats.
To get you guys going.
Just to stock it, because we had some good years there and we're looking at our grass budgets and they were just, there was just so much feed. And
how long ago, how long ago did you start going into goats? How long ago was this?
Oh, we've owned Eastfield for 2 years now. So pretty much as soon as we bought Eastfield.
Just hooked in.
Just because we had, I don't know, had a heaps of equity in, we were comfortable because we'd been in so much debt all our lives. So we weren't scared of debt.
Yeah.
So we were happy to go into debt to buy stock that was going to make us money. And we were buying some goats from down around Charleville and Cunnamulla, and these goats were just wild things that they'd trapped, and we were paying $150 for these nannies, and we could hardly get them in the yard, mate. Like, they're just so hard to muster. They don't move together as a mob. They spread out in groups of four or five, and obviously it's very scrubby country where we are. We spent 2-3 hours with a helicopter mustering 2,000 acres, and we still missed like 100 or 200 bloody goats.
So that was definitely a steep learning curve when you first started stepping in.
Yeah, ridiculous.
What are some of the things that you changed? Are you just harvesting the goats, or are you actually managing them?
No. We're starting to get a handle on them. Laneways are 100% necessary.
Yep.
So we've got laneways up now and trap yards on waters.
Yeah, okay.
But recently I've just bought, after that podcast you did with Luke Chaplin with the drones, I've bought a drone with thermal imaging.
Yeah.
And so I've been getting up at like 2:30 in the morning, go out to the paddock, and at night, it's funny, they seem to be all camped in mobs. Like, must be a natural thing for predators at nighttime or whatever. And it's quite easy. They respond really, really well to that drone. You wouldn't think so. I just get up and muster them into a lane or a holding square or something. And geez, I'll tell you what, it's made a big difference. And I've only done it probably, for the about 5 or 6 times I've done it, but I tell you what, I think it's going to be a game changer for us.
So that's saved you the chopper costs and stuff like that with mustering. And that's the thermal camera and the speaker, like Luke talked about. You got a speaker that blasts them out?
The speaker might, I've got a speaker, but I don't use it. They respond well enough without it. And I think that the speaker, you'd have to ask Luke, but it might drain the battery a bit quicker because it's like a funnel catching the air or whatever. But so that's where we're up to with the goats, and just you know, we've got to start pulling the billies out so that they're not kidding all year round, and try and just concentrate on getting more of that boar, keeping the boar nanny so we get a better meat yield when we're killing, and I don't know, just try and get it a bit more civilized, break the wieners in and, yeah, be able to handle them without, look at, like, drive around.
Yeah.
And not just
have them while going
run into the bushes, you never see them sort of thing. Like.
So, like, touching on the learning curves, and I want to start moving towards what you guys are doing, butcher to go there, but initially, was this one of the struggles, was the marketing piece? Is this why you started heading the way to setting up Butcher to Go, or what was the struggle? Because you've only literally got one place to send goats, don't you?
There's Charleville and Bourke as abattoirs, which export 98% of goat meat out of Australia. So there's not really a domestic market. There is a huge domestic market, but no one's supplying it, right?
Yeah.
But what kept the goat market up so high for so long was the restocker market, and that totally dropped off. No one was buying females or anything. So then we were stuck with the two major exporters, and they basically had a monopoly, and there was just thousands of goats around, and people were starting to get dry, and the price plummeted from where it was. And people kept saying that there was a domestic demand from just little goat farmers that we knew around, that, you know, the different cultures had come out and kill their goats themselves and say that they didn't need to sell anywhere else except for the different cultures and stuff. And that's probably where the idea came from, necessity, or just, you know, something to try and get rid of goats, or just, I don't know. I've seen the idea on TikTok of Jacob Walke, a guy down in New South Wales, doing this butcher shop. And I said to Karen, that'd be a great idea.
Yeah.
And we decided, well, we need to test the market before we spend a lot of money setting up a shop or whatever. But Karen will tell you more about how it all went, because she was the one doing the hard yard, selling the goats out of the back of her minivan, and some pretty dodgy setup at the start.
So, can you tell us a bit more about the initial starting off of Butcher to Go? Because obviously you're wearing a Goat to Go shirt, so that's where it began, the idea, and it's grown.
Yeah. So Goat to Go was initially the idea, and so like I said, we wanted to test the market first. Like in the past, we realised that we'd always jumped in, and so now it would be good just to see is it right? Is it real that there is a domestic demand? And so we just put like a Facebook post out on, I think it was Townsville Buy Swap Sell, just saying we got some goats, and which was interesting. You can't actually advertise for live animals or meat on Facebook Buy Swap Sell. So you had to do it, which I realized you had to do it a bit cryptic. And I just thought, I don't think this is going to work, because I don't know if you realize what I'm trying to say here. But it was just amazing. It didn't take long before the messages started rolling in asking for, at that stage, we're just offering whole goats. And a local abattoir was happy to kill them for us. And just that was a learning curve on its own, like, you know, raising the animals and then retailing them is a whole different ball game, isn't it?
Yes, there'd be so much around there, actually, just the killing, getting them killed properly, the health standards, the food safety standards and stuff like that. That'll probably come in later with the butcher to go. But at the start, they're just trying to get someone to kill them initially.
Yeah. And then just for me, being a bit naive, was like the cuts of goat, like what's good, what's not, where's what, you know, sort of thing.
And goats are easy, though.
They are. We worked it. They are pretty good. And so what our routine was we would deliver them on a Friday evening in a car park at Townsville.
Like a drug deal.
I know. And because the boys would play footy in Townsville on the Saturday. So, and we have family in Townsville. So we pick up the meat in Eskies, I might add. Like it wasn't, you know, oh my gosh.
So I would pick up the meat, put all the in eskies, put the ice in and make sure it's all good, and then pick up the kids with all and have all the footy gear in the back of the minivan. And then with five kids, I would go to this car park and schedule a time to meet like
this is a
these
drop.
People. Yeah. And I'm thinking every week I was like, someone is surely going to come and talk to me about selling meat out of the back of my car. And, but you know, it was really great. It was hectic, but I chose a place where the kids could run around quite easily and safely. Well, you know, we waited for the customers to come and I just got to know them, and they're just so lovely. And they were so grateful to be able to get fresh goat meat, because they said, like, I've heard so many stories about immigrants coming and they just, because goat was such a big part of their diet back home and up north especially, like what they could get was frozen product or yeah. It was inconsistent product because, you know, they might have got an old buck or a billy or some, you know, that had a bit of age, a bit of smell and a bit of chew to it. So they were just so grateful to have something that they could give me feedback on, which I loved getting. And I love how honest they were. And they said, "This, Karen, this is what we like and this is why," you know. So it was a bit of education process for me too. So I'm so grateful for that process before we started the butcher shop. It was a good learning curve. And my first customers are still customers today, so which is really cool.
So that was initially your minimal viable product, I suppose, as they'd say, with marketing and stuff like that. Like, you were out there pounding the pavement, pounding the car parks, testing this idea. Yeah. Did you have the, like you said, you initially had the idea of the butcher shop, but was this all at the same time, this kind of evolving, or was this like the initial trial, or?
Yeah.
What was that process? Yeah.
It was the initial trial. And it's so funny because I'm always up, Kale, about TikTok. And then now we come across Jacob Welpe's. And so after it was working for a bit, we realized that there is probably a bit of demand out there. We organized to have a chat with Jacob and he was amazing. Like, just so transparent, you know, which is not everybody is about their business practices. And we said, but we were thinking that we liked the idea and what do you think about starting one up here? And he was just so great in sharing what he had learnt, how he did it. And kudos to him. Like, this was from scratch, open. You know, like he found the company for the app company. He found like how to do the PIN code, like the whole process. Like, I was so lucky. Well, we were so lucky that we didn't have to think of any of that. He gave it to us on a plate, you know, and so grateful to Jacob for that. And he was only wanted to see us succeed. And it was really, really nice to see another grazier support you like that.
So you found a shop front. Yeah. You initially went from the car park to talking to Jacob and you found somewhere in the end.
That's interesting. So I was delivering to some restaurants as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't come to the car park. I would actually deliver to them. And this one particular restaurant I delivered to was on Charters Towers Road.
Yeah.
And we were a bit early with the kids and they had just picked them up from school. And I thought, well, we're too long to stay in the car, so let's go for a walk. And literally just down the road across the street was a shop for lease and it was right next to an Indian restaurant. And not far down the road was an Indian grocer.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it was all around that, but that was a big part of their customer base.
Mm.
So I thought, well, maybe this is something, you know. And so I rang up the agent the next day and he gave me all the details and we thought, well, we could do this. And we did. In September, we opened up the butcher shop.
How does it work? If I'm a new customer wanting to go in and get some of your amazing product, what's the process of me signing up what am I doing?
Yeah, okay. So most people go to our website, which is butcher2go.com.au.
I'll throw it in the notes.
I do? Yeah, I wasn't sure if we do that. So there's a become a member part of there. And they fill out this form. It's really simple. It's basically their name, their number, their email, and they choose a 6-digit PIN. And beside the membership form is the steps on how to download the app. So it's all there.
It's all there.
All there so they can be ready. And then that is sent to us. I have a really good woman helping me out in the admin side. That once it started growing, I was like, oh, my gosh, I really need some hand here to help sign up new members. And Yeah, she's amazing. So we, from Tuesdays to Thursdays, we activate our new members now. And so that process is we, so you, like I said, that pin is unique to you. So mm-hmm. what you choose is unique to you in the sense that when you enter the shop, it's time stamped. So I can know that that's you entering and what time you entered. Then you will use an app, which is called Express Checkout. And that app scans the labels on the barcode and you pay through the app. And then that's it, really.
Okay, so I just grab my rump or whatever I want to grab out and scan it.
Yeah.
That's
great. Yeah.
That's how often are you guys delivering, or what's the process of delivery of getting the goats? And now you not only do goats, you also do beef, I see, as well. So what's the process of getting the animals slaughtered and bringing them?
Yeah. So like you said, when we started this, we realized, well, for this butcher shop to work, it wouldn't just be goats. I don't think it would be enough, you know. So we realized then, and our mates were fantastic in saying that, oh, we'll supply the beef.
Yeah.
And we knew that would be good. Fantastic in the sense that they always have supply, because I think that's always a bit of a tricky bit when you're trying to do paddock to plate, is with droughts and everything that happens in life, always having that consistent product.
And it's really high quality grass fed.
Good beef.
Like no antibiotics, no hormones. Like it's hitting that market of clean and healthy, which people are becoming more and more aware of.
Yeah.
And like it's getting harder and harder to trust these third party certifications. Like you can label meat as grass fed, but it's been finished on grain. You know, and it's the customers haven't got time to research all the nitty gritty about every third party certification. That they just want to know the farmer, that where it's come from, and have that sort of certification from the farmer saying it's 100% clean,
it's good
straight from the paddock beef. And it's sort of it's a growing market, and there's, as people become more and more conscious of their health, there's demand there. Yeah.
It's also, the shop is 24/7.
Yeah.
So the members can go in anytime. And I think there's a lot of shift workers out there who are really appreciating the fact they don't have to rely on Woolies or Coles, because they can never catch a butcher so that's been really cool too.
So I'll just bring it back. So you get the goats and cattle killed down in Longreach, I think you said. Is that right? And then do you bring it up? What days do you bring it up? Or how often are you bringing up fresh meat?
Yeah, so I normally bring about 50 to 100 goats into Charters Towers here.
Yeah.
And Karen's got a little trailer. She gets 10 or 15 of them in a week and we've got sheep here as well. She takes into Dan's Country Meats there, who processes the
goats.
The goats and sheep.
Yep.
Then because the bloke that's supplying our beef, Peter Britton and Luke Britton, they bought the ag college there at Longreach. So that's got that beautiful processing facility out there. So it's a lot easier for him to get the beef, or easier for us to get it killed out there and then just freight it in a box.
Yeah.
Freight is the biggest expense, and the killing. The freight, like that, there's not a good, really good margin in the beef. Like, you know, you got a 500 kilo animal yields, say 50%, so 250, just to roughly. And then out of that, what is it? Like 30% of that is bone. So you end up with 70% of the carcass weight. And then there's only like 20% of that that is like rump, fillet,
steak.
High quality steak cuts that sell really well. And this was a learning curve as well, working out how to cut this bloody animal up so people buy them. And anyway, I'm getting off track, but yeah, we pick it up from Longreach, bring it up on Thursday, and then Karen takes the goat, the sheep, and the beef to the butcher shop on Friday. and that's it. Once a week, drop off and restock. Yeah,
that's it's very interesting what you said about the wastage. Like, it is something probably a lot of people don't realize. Mm. And there's probably that discrepancy in the understanding. Like, some people always go, why is the steak at the store, $15 or whatever, and we're selling for $3? Well, it's because of, live weight. It's because of that. It's because, like, when you get there, there's only 70% that you use.
Yeah.
And there's a discrepancy where whichever meatworks you use, it's always a big discrepancy of how much wastage by the time your trimmings, your bones and stuff gets out. There's not much of that animal that actually people eat at the very end. Do you guys actually, and touching on that, do you guys sell like some pet meat or pet bones as well in the shops for like on that almost value added product? Do you guys capture that as well?
Yeah, we do. We have a special chest freezer.
Yep.
That's designated to pet food.
Yeah.
And pet bones. So with some of our product that we saw was getting towards that isn't moving, we would sometimes put it into the pet food as well.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really happen as much anymore. I actually had a customer ask the other day if we're getting any more of that particular meat in for the pet food. So it is interesting that people are wanting it for their pets and, how much quality they want to give to their pets.
Can I say, when you see the price of sausage dogs lately?
Yeah. So that's a whole nother market too that we haven't really touched on much. We just, like, this shop is only really since September, so it's 4-5 months old.
Yeah.
And the learning curves have been steep again.
It's going to be really cool. And this is what I want to do with the podcast as well, is come back to people, because there's a couple of people I've interviewed so far and you guys are definitely one. It'd be interesting to see what the next 2 years bring and where you're at or what's evolved from it, because it's such an interesting process of what you guys are up to now. It'd be so cool to see where your journey takes you.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, we had some lady she calls herself Townsville Eats, like a social promoter for food and stuff in Townsville, went in there and done a post, which she has a lot of followers. So it's like, I don't know, got 20,000 views this video or something. And we had like 200 members sign up in like 3 days and just totally wiped out the stock.
Jesus.
And it's a 2 week lag time. That the hardest thing is knowing how many to kill. Because there's not a really big margin in it. It's, if you kill too many, you're going to lose money even if you do sell most of it.
It's a fine,
but
line.
It's exciting because people are very excited about the idea of it. And
we touched on it before. It's that connection piece.
Yeah.
They know people are wanting to become, and consumers are wanting to know more about where their food comes from and the health benefits of it. They know about eating, clean, green and, healthy, they don't want a lot of additives in their food. Like, yeah, it's really interesting what the consumer's doing and focusing on that and being able to see where their meat's coming from, relate it back to a story, is such a big positive.
Yeah, yeah. And also, like, people say, what about theft? Because people could literally just walk in there, grab the meat and walk out and not pay, right?
Yeah. Have you had much?
Oh, well, we don't think so.
Yeah.
And I mean, Jacob, he's right onto it and he's had no theft since he was been operating for probably 3 years or something now. But I think people respect that we trust them. And if they steal off us, it's going to be off stealing off a farmer.
Yeah.
And we're able to price it at lower than Woolies. For the Woolies grass-fed stuff, our prices are lower. And we think better quality.
Yeah.
Just because we don't have that staff issue and we don't have to deal with people.
dealing
with staff and we don't have to pay staff. So it's a good model.
It's like a modern day honesty box.
Yeah.
Yeah. For busy farmers, the hardest part about doing the paddock to plate is the time.
The selling. The farmers markets, like you see people.
Yeah, doing. And it's hard to sell quarter beasts because people don't want to spend $500 at a time. A lot of people don't have that money. They want to go in and buy, you know, two packets of sausages for 20 bucks, and then when they get paid next week, they'll go and buy a rump steak. Like,
it's a good point. It's a really good point that you're making around that. And look, I am aware of the time because it's been a long one this episode. It's been a great one though, because I reckon I could have done a part two on this. I should have probably done a part two on this. But look, I want to wrap it up because I'm, like I said, aware of your time. But just touching on a couple of things that you guys have mentioned, and I always ask the same three questions. And I think the big one is, like, you guys mentioned you've done a lot of different courses between you. Which one combined between yourselves that you believe you got the most out of, that's benefited you most so far?
I would have to say the RCS process. So GFP would be the, because it was the first one, that broke the mold, broke the thinking patterns. So GFP. And then EL would be the next one I would choose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd definitely say the whole RCS process from grazing for profit, including Executive Link, and having that mastermind group of the board is very, very powerful.
Have you guys had any mentors along your journey that have helped you out?
Yeah, definitely had mentors, other graziers and older fellas that, you know, they've always got words of wisdom. And yeah, it's, you're always running things past them and whatnot. And anyway, I normally end up doing whatever I want anyway. I never really listen to them.
Karen, what about yourself? Have you had any mentors that have helped you out?
I suppose because most of our, everything we've done is together.
Yeah.
It'd be those graziers. But it's also talking to the women, you know, they've got, once again, those little one-liners, those little bit of insights, you know, the experience of being on the land, being married to a grazier. You know,
it's not easy.
I think there's a lot of respect I have, especially for, and I often think back to the pioneer women.
Yeah.
And I just think, wow, like
what
they went through just blows my mind. So we're lucky these days, really. But I think family, definitely, and those graziers that we've met along the way.
I always think of that, like the same thing with pioneer women. My granny's like 5 foot, this little old lady, sharp as, just cheekiest person you'll ever meet. But you look at her and this small, sweet old lady, and you reflect on back what she went through at the time. Like, they lived up at Harvey's Range in the hill. They'd have months where they'd be cut off from anywhere, you know, with three kids running around, and you're just like, you are one tough son of a gun.
Yeah.
Like, but now you look at her, she's a sweet little old lady, and we really take for granted some of the journeys that they've gone through previously, historically. So shout out to Granny out there. She'd be listening, hopefully. what would be, you know, I want to get two answers here. What would be your one piece of advice that you give to someone along this journey on land ownership or in life?
I think my advice would be to have your vision. Why are you doing it? I think that's, like, we've had so many failures. Like, if you could really put that down, we've had so many things that we've done wrong or made mistakes, but it's really been, we were never defined by those mistakes.
Yeah.
Because we knew where we wanted to go and we did get there. So you never know how you're going to get there. Like, you might set that goal and think this is the way you're going to get there, but you just never know. So I think really take that time
and be honest with yourself and think, what do you really want in life? Where do you want to go? And then talk to that partner you're on that journey with and see if they marry up together. And so that would be one of my biggest advices is, and also to the younger ones, I suppose the future generation, and just if it doesn't feel right, voice it.
Yep.
And draw those boundaries in the sand a lot deeper, you know, initially. I think, yeah, that would be my two things.
What about you, Carl?
Yeah, probably something that I still struggle with and I need to take more of my own advice is don't look backwards into the past. It's easy to look back and try and see where you would be. Like, let's say, for instance, that we probably lost like $6 million on if we had stayed at Palomana. And but who knows how that would have panned out? You know, like there is this one little story. If I've got time, I'd like to say.
I'll let you slip in.
It's a little thing that there was this Chinese father and son. They're working this field, right? And their only way to make money is with this old horse, and they've got to grow these radishes or whatever. They're making bugger all money, but that's their only income. And then the horse gets away, and the son goes into his dad and he says, "Dad, that's it. We're done. It's all over. How are we going to make money?" And the dad says, "I don't know, mate. It's too early to call. I can't call it." And the son just thinks he's crazy. He's mad. Something wrong with him, right? But anyway, the next day, the horse comes back, but he's got like 50 other horses with him. He runs straight in the gate in the paddock. The son runs down, shuts the gate, goes back to his Chinese dad. He says, "Dad, we're going to be rich. We're not making bloody ground radishes anymore. We're going to be breaking horses and get rich, right?" So then anyway, the son's out there and he's breaking these horses, right? And he just got no experience. He comes off, he breaks his leg. And the whole village is like, "My God," goes up to the father. He's like, "You're done. That's it. You're too old to work, mate. Your son's broke his leg." And he's like, "I don't know. It's too early to call. I can't call it." Anyway, so the whole village thinks that he's done. And then the next day, 8,000 warriors ride up to the house and say, "We need your son. We're going to war with some other tribe or whatever." The father says, "I can't. I can't give him to you. You know, I would, but his leg's broken." And then them 8,000 warriors ride off to their death. So, you know, it's always, you don't know where life's going to go. I think so, everything happens for a reason, and you can't call something straight away. You have to see it, what it is, for what it is down the track. And I don't know, that's the advice. Just don't look into the past, mate, and keep going forward. Yeah.
I like it. Look, thank you very much for jumping on and telling your story as Karen whisks away a child who's running amok in the background. But the joys. But look, thank you very much, and I greatly appreciate it. And yeah, looking forward to see where you guys go in the future.
Right, good on you, Sam. Thank you very much. I love the podcast, mate, and keep going, eh?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to another episode of A Place to Call Home podcast. If you have enjoyed it, please leave a rating and click the follow button. It is the best way you can help and support the podcast. And if you got 5, maybe share the episode with some friends and family. You never know, it could help them out. Anyway, for the quote of the day, I want to leave you one from Jim Rohn. And it says, "Your life does not get better by chance, it gets better by change." Have a great day.